They spoke about your arm not being down beside your side. I mean, this is not Irish dancing.
OTB Sports Radio.
Basketball would have been my main game.
The brand new sports radio station from Off the Ball.
That's my point. Don't play for us if you're a proud Englishman.
Now broadcasting 24 hours a day. Live on the Go Loud app. Alexa.
You have a whole new world of possibilities.
Google Home. Tune in. And offtheball.com/radio.
This is OTB Sports Radio.
The OTB Podcast Network.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Shearer and Owen.
Okay, you're welcome back. Now, as you know, over the last couple of weeks, in lieu of not having any Premier League commentary, we've been talking to different footballers who've played in the top flight and beyond. There are a whole host of them waiting for you. If you want to go back and listen, we've had Matt Holland, we've had Jim Beglin, we've had Ronnie Whelan, and this week we have Damien Delaney, a regular voice in the show. Damien, how you doing?
How's it going, Joe? Geez, that's a fairly illustrious company I'm in there when you read that out.
Well, listen, you're right up there. I mean, you've had quite the career. I was just looking back. That's a lot of professional games of football. And you've been playing, played a long time from 1998 through until 2019, really? That's a decent stint. So it's not so bad. How's life, first of all?
Good, man. Pretty good. Can't complain. I would say enjoying retirement, but we have a new baby here, so it kind of keeps you. I say baby, he's two now, like, so for the last 2 years I've been chasing him around and enjoying being a dad, really.
How goes lockdown?
Good. You know, I think my own fella doesn't realise it, so he wakes up in the morning and it's a normal day for him, and you know, as long as the weather's nice, you can take him out in the back garden, and I mean, he'll pot around the back garden on his own for a few hours, and I can just sit down and watch him, and he's happy out. So that's pretty much it. Keep fit with a bit of cycling, road bike, a few times a week. And other than that, just life is good.
I should tell the listeners who can't see us, those of you watching on YouTube will know, but you've done an awful job on your hair. You're usually a man who runs a tight ship there. It usually looks very slick, very fashionable, and it's cool that you put your own.
It's horrific, isn't it? You know what, look, I did this because my fringe was going in my eyes, so I cut up myself last. Oh, it was some crack.
Think Dumb and Dumber if you're listening.
Pretty much, yeah.
Here's an interesting one for you. So are you missing watching football? Is it a big hole in your life?
Actually, it's not. It's really not. I mean, believe it or not, when I was playing, I didn't watch that much football. Because you spend so much time watching clips on the opposition, that you're playing that week, and I was a big video watcher or kind of a clip watcher of teams that we were playing coming up an awful lot. So when you kind of do that, and then the game, you finish your game on a Saturday, when you're kind of sitting home on Sunday, you don't really want to watch football. So I'm not missing it, to be honest. Yeah, not at all. I kind of miss, you know, what I miss about football, the structure it brings to your week. You know, like Tuesday night was Tuesday night Champions League and Saturday was Saturday. At the minute, when you've got no kind of markers in your life, you don't know whether it's Monday, Tuesday or Wednesday. So I kind of miss that, you know. If you watch maybe goals on Sunday, on a Sunday morning or something, just to get all the games. Something like that lets you know it's a Sunday. And at the minute, without all that, it's pretty difficult.
We've got to know each other a little bit via Champions League nights up in Off the Ball, where you'll come up and watch the big Champions League games. Or, well, you sat through the group stages, what should have been the good nights we haven't quite had yet. But I know that you'll come up and you'll spend a lot of the day around Dublin on your own. Like, sometimes you golf with Keith Andrews or you're a big cinema fan. But a lot of it is solitary time as well, walking around Dublin, discovering Dublin. For some people, that would be their idea of hell, that much thinking time. Whereas I do get the impression you quite enjoy solitary time, thinking time. Yeah. I don't know if you're an introvert or not, but you could do it differently those Champions League days, I suspect. You choose to have a bit of time to yourself.
I love it. I always have done. I definitely wouldn't say I'm an introvert, but I don't mind being on my own. And I think it was a fabulous trait for me in my career, because if you're playing football, you do spend an awful lot of time on your own, especially when you're younger. You know, how many times have we heard stories of lads go over to the UK and they really, really struggled? I don't know if you were there tonight, but Jack Byrne came in the studio. Was it you? Yeah, I remember Jack was saying, sorry, that he really struggled. And I kind of said to him, I didn't. I loved it. So when the training was finished, I'd happily go home. And then I can pass away time. That's why this lockdown hasn't been too severe on me either. I'd always find something to do. I go for a walk, which I don't mind doing. And when you say there that I like thinking, I do. I don't overthink things. I like thinking and running through things in my mind, but I don't let it bog me down, or I don't let it get on top of me. Even in the summers in football, I used to go on holidays on my own. And I know a lot of people won't like say that. I would go to America on my own, and I quite happily, you know, if there was an international break in the November or whenever, or February, March, when whichever one was, I'd gone to New York several times on my own. And I would happily just potter around New York on my own in winter, you know, and sit in a bar and have a few beers and just walk. I like walking around cities, and I like enjoying things. And it's a very good trait to have if you're a footballer.
Yeah, no, it sounds great. And would you be someone who'd want to strike up conversation with people in the bar, or just quite happy to do a bit of watching?
Yeah, I always like meeting interesting people. You know, I spent an awful lot of time in Chicago, where I used to go quite a lot. One of my friends is an Irish bar out there, so I spent quite a lot of time in there. You know, obviously he'd be working and whatnot, and I kind of sit at the bar and, you know, people walk in, you end up having a chat for whatever. Sometimes it's a good conversation, sometimes it's not. But, you know, I don't expect anything from it, or I don't want anything from it. It's just a chat, really, you know. And you do meet some quite interesting people when you're traveling. So I do like being on my own, don't get me wrong. So I do enjoy those Champions League days, pottering around Dublin.
I know as well that you're very interested. It's not just kind of internal rumination about yourself. I know you're interested in the world around you. Like, you do come in, and you've often been listening to podcasts which are hosted by people who wear tinfoil hats and a bit.
This tinfoil hat conspiracy theory, they're all terms that were coined by the CIA to demonize, you know, free thinkers. No, but listen, I think when I like to listen to a lot of independent media, and I like to listen to a lot of people that offer different points of view. I don't take any of it seriously, and don't get me wrong, I do listen to a lot of independent media, and I laugh at some of the stuff I hear, because it's so far out there and it's so mad. But sometimes these people offer a different opinion, a different view on an opinion, and I like listening to that. I don't do anything with it, but it's just something that kind of maybe gets your mind thinking that maybe there is something else going on, or maybe that there are reasons for certain things happening that maybe, you know, I'm going to use the phrase mainstream media won't say or can't say, you know. So I like listening to things like that, and I like reading about certain things like that, you know. But I'm not a tinfoil hat.
No, I know. It's an ongoing slag, which is slightly unfair. Were you always interested in the world that way? Like, when you were 16, 17, 18, were you thinking in those terms? Were you hoovering up books, or has that come a bit later in life?
No, you know what? I was a massive, or I still am, an autobiography reader. I love reading about other people's lives and the things they went through, and the troubles and struggles and triumphs that they had, you know. So I haven't so much in the last couple of years now that I have a kid, but I mean, that's how I spend a lot of my time, you know, reading autobiographies and biographies of people that are from all different walks of life, musicians, you know, politicians, leaders in the world, you know, historical leaders, just finding out about them really. And as I say, I don't take anything from it, or I'm not looking for inspiration, but it's just nice to see that other people, what they've gone through and stuff. And maybe sometimes when you find out you're going through some difficult times, you realize you're not the only one, you know. So it's okay, it happens to everyone, you know. You just got to get through it.
Were you good at school? Did that appeal to you?
No, I was absolutely terrible at school. Not simply because I liked football too much, just wanted to play sports, so I didn't really have much of an interest in school or whatever. So I left school here in Cork after my junior cert.
Did you?
Which was a huge risk, you know. I remember sitting down having a conversation with my mother, because I'd been over and tried to the UK a few times, and nothing had come of it. But around the time, I think it was 98, 99, FOSS courses were starting to start up. Everybody knows these, you know. But I think I was on the second one that was in Cork. So that was in 98, I'm going to say. And the year before me, Liam Miller and Colin Healy did the FOSS course, the first one, and the FOSS course in Cork were run by Mick Conroy and Paul Bannon, who sadly has passed now. But Mick is still doing the FOSS courses here in Cork. I know they're quite popular and stuff, but, you know, I did it, and it was, you know, we did football twice a day and stuff. So I remember asking my junior cert, I think that was the day my mother realised the school wasn't for me, because my grades and my results weren't that good. So I remember saying, can I do this FOSS course? And she reluctantly said yes, on the promise that if nothing came of it, I would go back and do my Leaving Cert in the College of Commerce in Cork. So that was kind of the deal I struck with her. And the year the FOSS course ended, was luckily the town of Cork City were transitioning from a semi-professional team to a full-time professional team. So they were all going full-time. So I basically came out of the fourth course and went into being a full-time footballer at Cork City. I was only 17 at the time, or 18 or whatever it was, you know.
Roy Keane came through and does Forest courses as well. Even though it's such a long shot, they've produced a few players. Your poor mum, your two-year-old in 13, 14 years' time sits down and says, Dad, I've been thinking about it. I'm ditching school and I'm going to go on the Forest course with the hope that I'll become a footballer. You'll have your head in your hands.
I'd say don't be a dreamer, son. Finish out your school.
I'm surprised your mum. My mum says there's not a chance. There is not a chance. I don't care if you're going to fail. You're getting back in there and you're doing it.
Yeah, but see, when I was over in the UK, like one of the biggest things for me when I was a young fella, right, and I was going over on trial, the first time I went over, what was big for me was I wanted to see behind the curtain, you know, because when you're playing football here in Cork and, you know, you're doing okay and you always hear these stories about the standard and the level of the UK and everything, and I always kind of thought, all I want to do is see it, right? And if I go over there and see it and I'm not good enough, then no problem, I can come home and get on my life, because I realised football wasn't for me. I remember when I was, I'd say about 14 or 15, I went on trial to Manchester City. And Manchester City were a League One team at the time. Well, what's now League One, it was Division Three, or Division Two, sorry, at the time. So I went on trial, and I remember the first day of training, I was so nervous, because I was like, this is it. This is the thing that you've been thinking about. This is what, you know, the only thing that's, you know, kept you going. And first training session happened, and bear in mind, in that youth team in Man City at the time, like Sean Wright Phillips was there, who was like a 16-year-old. I remember Glenn Whelan, believe it or not, I don't know if I never spoke to Glenn about this actually, but Glenn was already signed by Man City, and he was kind of going over on school holidays and training at the time with them. And there was a couple of other fellas from Dublin, so you know, this is a time where we had to drive to Dublin to get a flight to Manchester. You know, there was no flights from, you know, there wasn't that many flights, and my flight was out of Dublin. I remember getting to Dublin Airport, and Glenn was there, and there was a couple of other Dublin lads and stuff. I remember getting over there, and then Sean Wright Phillips was there, and Joey Barton was there as well. So, and I remember training, and I remember thinking to myself, okay, they're obviously better than me, but they're not that much better than me, you know? No, maybe that is the delusion of me, to be honest with you, but I remember coming home thinking, okay, I know I've seen what the standard is. I know where I need to get to. I know what I need to do. And that's why the Forest course then, when it came around, was a big, because when you get to that age of football, if you're not in full-time professional football, you know, they're moving further and further away from me, and the gap is getting bigger. So that's why, like, the Forest course was my life raft, really, to kind of catch up to the to what I needed to, because it got me out of, you know, training Tuesday, Thursday nights, playing for your school, playing for 5-6 different teams. I just went and I played. And the Forest courses back then were, like, it was double football. I don't know, speaking to people, there's a lot of school work and they kind of prepare them for, you know.
Okay. Sorry. For radio listeners, the face you just made when you said the word school work.
No, but now there is. I know, because I met McConroy not so long ago, and like he was saying to me that, like, you know, oh, now we have a lot of, like, getting kids ready to go to colleges and prepare them for life.
All that nonsense, all that silly stuff.
Whereas for us, it was like double football. Yeah. It was football in the morning, have your sandwiches, and football in the evening, you know, and it was just like 2 days.
You must have felt yourself improving rapidly at that age.
Oh, hugely. Because right about that time, I joined Cork City's youth team. And that year, we won the FAIU Cup. But on that Cork City youth team, I think there was four or five of us were on the Forest course, you know. And I remember the fellas, I won't go through all the names, Damien O'Rourke and stuff. But there was a few of us there, and you could tell that, like, when we were playing games, we were winning 4-0, because we had four or five guys that were, like, full-time professionals playing against guys who weren't. Obviously, they were still at school or they were working or whatnot. So I remember when we played the Dublin teams, it was always good for me. You know, I think we beat Belvedere Boys, which was, you know, personal highlight for me.
Stick it to those dubs.
Oh, 100%, because they used to thrash us when we were schoolboys, you know. No, I know that Belvedere probably lost all their players to UK teams by the time. But it didn't matter. I still took it as a win. But anyway, that's how it kind of progressed for me, and that's why that Forest course. But I do agree with you. I always thank my mother for that, for believing in me enough to say, all right, you can leave school at 16, 17 and you know, continue to dream.
Ultimately, I know Leicester and Peter Taylor was where you first made your foray over into the UK game. Were you getting noticed at that stage? Were there other trials happening? Was the dream starting to get away from you?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I went to Preston after, I went to Man City a couple of times, and they said they, you know, they liked me, whatever, whatever, and, you know, the U team, the director of the U team at the time, or the whatever, director of football at the time, said to me, listen, you know, you're 16, 17, you know, if it was a year earlier, we'd definitely take you. You know, you need a year's work, you know, you have something, but, you know, you feel that others are a little bit ahead of you, blah, 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 whatever. And I kind of went, okay, fair enough. So I knew that, like, you know, with a bit of work I could, and I went over to Preston on trial. It was the same thing, you know, just I was 17 at the time, and I said, you have to go straight into a U team, and, you know, if you had you at 16, I said, that's fine, man. And then I kind of went home, went to the Falls course, Cork City went full time, and I was happy. You know, I was getting 70 Irish punts a week at Cork City. Life was good, living at home. I just got my first car, you know. Life was okay. And I started the season for Cork City, and that was right around the time Cork City had some, you know, fantastic senior pros, old school, you know. So for me to go into a changing room with, you know, like the John Caulfield, Pat Morley, Patsy Frayne, Kelvin Flanagan, Decky Daly, Derek Collins, Stevie Napier, Phil Harrington, you know, like those real old school tough footballers, you know. I remember, you know, people like Mark Herrick, they were just taking no prisoners in what they did. You know, training was, you know, difficult enough, you know. So I went in that environment and I got beat up quite a lot, and it was good for me. And then I remember I started the season for Cork City, and I did reasonably well in the few games that I played. I think I remember scored against Bowes, I think, in the pre-season thing. And then started the season. And then Derek Mountfield, who played for Everton in the 80s, won FA Cup, and I'm going to say European Cup, I'm not certain on that, was a manager. And I remember he just phoned me one day and he said, can you come and see me? So I kind of think, what have I done? You know, was I out of the weekend, or, you know, am I getting dropped? Was my, you know, my initial thought, like, you know. And so I went and seen him in his hotel in Cork, and he said, look, do you want to go and train with Leicester for a week? And I kind of thought, oh my God, okay, fair enough. And he goes, okay, go. So I remember I went over to Leicester and went and trained with them, and I was training with the first team, believe it or not, you know, went straight into it. And I did, I definitely went over with a bit of a kind of a, I don't say an easy Aussie attitude, but like a kind of, life is good for me right now, you know, I'm not going to complain about anything. If something comes, it doesn't, but I've been rejected so many times beforehand, I kind of, my hopes weren't up. But I realised that I had a good safety net and going back to Cork City, which I was happy doing. So I kind of went over and said, look, just enjoy the week, you know, you're probably going to get told, you know, we like your, the usual stuff. And I remember on the Friday, my last day, I was flying back out of Birmingham to Cork, and after training, one of the coaches said to me, the gaffer wants to see you after your lunch, so before you go to the airport, make sure you see the gaffer. So I kind of thought, well, obviously he's going to come in and say thanks for training. Yeah, so I went in and he said, how did you find it? And I said, yeah, it was good, I enjoyed it. He said, right, do you want to sign? And I kind of thought, what? And he went, do you want to sign? And I said, oh, I don't know, like, where's this come from? And he said, well, the secretary outside has the standard first year pro contract. If you sign it on your way out, we'll see you Monday morning. Whoa. And that was, I'm not lying, that was literally it. So okay. I flew home on the Friday night and then flew back on the Sunday. And that was it, into Diggs in Leicester, and into a room where there was like eight, like, lads, you know, well seasoned, well experienced English lads from big cities in the UK. That was it. Sink or swim time, you know. So I just went in, and I remember that Monday night. So I signed, came back on the Monday, went to training, and they went, oh, there's a reserve team game tonight against Tottenham at White Hart Lane. The bus is leaving at like lunchtime. And I was like, going, wait, what? I've only just like come in. And they went, yeah, so just get your stuff. So I was straight on the bus and went straight down, and Monday night I played a reserve team game against Tottenham at White Hart Lane, and I just remember walking out on the White Hart Lane going, oh my God, this is just like amazing. I don't even know it was only a reserve team game, because at the time reserve teams used to play on Monday night. So that was it, really, and then I was off and running, really.
That is insane. I didn't know it happened like that.
Yeah, really. I mean, my mother was distraught. I think she was then having regrets about letting me do the Falls course.
Yeah. She was like, what? You're moving to where?
I know my boy phone at the time, so I knew And I'm flying back to Cork, getting picked up at the airport, and then I had to tell them when I got to the airport. My dad picked me up, and I'm telling them, oh, by the way, I've signed, I'm going back on Sunday. And then that was it, like.
I already know the answer to this. I presume you went out, signed that contract without taking any advice from anybody.
Absolutely nothing. They told me it was but there literally was any negotiation on it. They just said to me, look, this is our standard entry level first year pro contract. So you're signing like a 2 year deal. So you get a first year pro, second year pro. In your second year, you get like a small little increase. But they said, this is it. And we put you in digs. So your accommodation, everything's taken care of. Remember that first week I got there? I mean, I didn't know. And this was way before player liaison officers and teams of people to look after you. I mean, I just remember going to digs and I was like, I had no money. I had no bank account. I had like no phone. I had like nothing.
Yeah. So I was like, this is Leicester in the Premier League, Leicester, is it?
Yeah. It was literally just get on with yourself. There, no, there's your digs. I remember walking down to the there's a bank about 200 yards up the road from me on Cavendish Road in Leicester. I walked into a Lloyd's TSB saying, can I open an account? And the woman's like, who are you? Like, and I was like, oh, well, you know, where would you have anything with your address on it? And I didn't. I was just like, I just live over there. And in fairness, she looked after me. She opened me up a bank account. And then I had to go back. I remember going back to the club at Leicester and there was nothing in the bank account. And I remember saying to them, I don't have any money. And they advanced me 2 weeks' wages because Leicester got paid by the month, didn't they? And like, this was early in the month, I think it was like 3 weeks of payday. And I was kind of going, I don't have any money. Like, so they advanced me like 2 weeks' wages and took it out of the first pay back that I got, like, you know. So, but once I got that, then I was fine.
You're 19 years of age then, give or take?
Yeah, I think it was 18, 19.
19. 2000, Leicester. That's still an old school, men were men, social
God.
Life, no. Dressing room slagging, hairdryer treatment. Did you find it all okay? Or you strike me as thick-skinned enough?
You know, it stood, the Cork City change room stood to me well, you know, because I learned not to take anything personal, because nothing is personal, you know, especially when you're a young kid, you kind of get the brunt of it. And when I mentioned all those Cork City players beforehand, you know, they were, you know, I mean, I remember coming back from Dublin and stopping in Kildare, slabs of beer being brought on the bus. And, you know, they were real old school type fellas like that, you know. So Cork did the Leicester change rooms kind of similar enough. You know,
yeah.
Matty Elliott, Frankie Sinclair, Jerry Taggart, Neil Lennon, Muzzy, is it, Robbie Savage. Like, I mean, you know, Steve Guppy was there, Andy Impey. I mean, Matty Elliott and Jerry Taggart were just two of the toughest men that I ever came across in my life. I was terrified of the two of them. You know, Jerry Taggart was all right to me because, you know, Jerry being from the north, like, he was, you know, he looked after me, in fairness to him. But I was terrified of him because he, like, in training, he was just a growling, snarling, you know, animal, really, in training. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I'd hate to get on the wrong side of that fella, like, you know. But this was a change room where there was regularly fights, like, fists thrown regularly in training and changing rooms after games and stuff, you know. It was a regular occurrence. So it was okay, though.
If we divide your career kind of broadly and maybe into two blunt-ish halves, say up until the end of your time at Hull, Leicester for a couple of years, a few loan spells, and then you go to Hull for 6 years. Mm-hmm. Who did you learn the most from, or what was your game like? Because I never would have seen you in this phase of your career. You know, I know the Crystal Palace years are the ones I really remember. So where was your game? Were you flying? Were you struggling? How did you do?
No, listen, I was really struggling my first year because I was still trying to find myself. Find my best position. Because at Leicester, I was playing left back. Leicester played three at the back at the time, so I played left side of three centre-backs. You know, centre-back, I played centre midfield. I played left side of three in the centre midfield as well. So, like, I had a variety of positions and I still didn't really know what I was. And I think the reason Leicester took a good chance on me is, you know, obviously, you know, I was left-footed, I was physically good, and I was fit. You know, I was, you know, undeniable. I was one of the fittest people at the club. Even when I went to Leicester, I just always was. You know, pre-season testing, I was always extremely fit. So that's kind of, they kind of thought, well, he has the structure of a player. We just need to put it together and find out, you know, what's his position and what does he do. And a lot of that was up to me. You know, I had to learn a position, pick a position. So when I went to Hull first, it was the same. You know, Peter Taylor, who had been sacked at Leicester, brought me to Hull. And Hull were, you know, bottom of Division 3.
Which is, you're a long way from Premier League career there.
A long, long. And I mean, when I signed for Hull, they were like still playing at Boothbury Park. They were second bottom of Division 3, so like one place away from going into the conference.
I'd never heard of Boothbury Park until I read that you're the last player to score a goal there for Hull today.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the old school, you know, Roker Park kind of, you know,
that era.
Yeah, baseball ground type grounds, you know, where they were just cobbled together and terracing and everything like that. But it was a fantastic place, and the pitch was always immaculate there, I remember that much. And we used to train behind the stadium. Actually, I tell you, like, we didn't have a training ground when I signed for Hull. So it was a case of meet at Boothbury Park, and we trained where we could get a pitch. So sometimes we had like a public kind of park where there was, you know, 20 pitches. Sometimes it was, there was a patch of grass behind the stadium that was about the size of half a football pitch, and sometimes it was there. But obviously when I got there, the KC Stadium was being built. The chairman who just bought it, Adam Pearson, said, look, you know, Peter Taylor's come here. We're not messing around. You know, we're really, but he said, this year we just need to stay in the league. And then this was the time as well before transfer windows. So I think my transfer was, you know, whatever. And then players were coming and going, and they were trying to strip down the squad and bring players in and stuff. So all this was going on. It was a bit of a mishmash. And then Peter Taylor did the same thing to me in my first year. I was playing centre-back, centre-midfield, left-back, and I was struggling a little bit, like really struggling. So much to the point where the fans were getting on top of me, because obviously the fans had been promised this new era of, like, you know, success, and Peter Taylor is trying to, like, get out a lot of dead wood and get in young, vibrant players, and there was a real crossover. Anyway, look, I didn't play very well that season, and then obviously the following season, then they had a summer to rebuild the whole team, and they did. They got rid of a lot of players, and they got in a lot of players. There was five or six young, similar to myself, players that had been released from Premier League clubs or let go or whatever, hungry players with a chip on their shoulder or something to prove. And I think if you get an environment where you have enough players with a chip on their shoulder, good things happen, you know, because they want to do well and they're motivated, and that's where we were. And then obviously that following year, we got back-to-back promotions into the championship. So within 2 years, by then I started to kind of sell Peter Taylor that following year. Then said to me, look, you're going to play centre-back. You know, primarily that's your position. You know, and he did a lot of work with me and Colin Murphy, who spent a lot of time, you know, at Shelburne and Dublin. And he was at Cork City as well for a period of time. Did a lot of work with me in terms of like teaching me basics and fundamentals, how to play centre-back. And I was lucky that I was playing in a winning team. So when I did make mistakes, we won 3-1, as opposed to, like, you know, when you make a mistake and you lose 1-0, it's horrific, because, I mean, you just, it's unforgivable. But like, we were 3-0 up, and I might make a mistake, and we won 3-1, and then it was almost then the gaffer pulling me on a Monday morning saying, hey, listen, you know, you shouldn't have done that. This is what you should have done. So it was a great learning environment for me as a young centre-back, because whatever you call it, centre-back is an experienced position. You know, there's not many young centre-backs. There are a few, don't get me wrong, but it's not a position that you can just throw kids in, because you will make mistakes. And if you make mistakes, invariably will lead to goals. So, you know, I was in a good learning environment so far, as we were winning every week. And we ended up getting back-to-back promotions. And then by the time we got into the championship, I had 2 full years of playing centre-back. You know, I often think of John Egan at Sheffield United at the minute, and I think he went a pretty similar route, you know, when he went to Sunderland. He left Sunderland, and then I think he bounced around with Gillingham and Brentford and had a promotion. And then you learn how to be a man, you learn how to be a footballer, you learn how to win games. And obviously now he's 26, 27 I think he is, and he's playing in the Premier League. But he never would have, when he left Sunderland, he wouldn't be the player that he is now. So he wouldn't have been able to step from Sunderland to Sheffield United in the first team. Sometimes you do have to go and learn, and especially when you're playing centre-back, because the lessons are too expensive to throw young kids in at centre-back in Premier League.
And what kind of professional are you? Because you're young, you know, good-looking lad, you're living the high life, you're probably the you know, you, local celebrity in Hull, I would say, to as the team. Like, is it all sorts of the old school antics?
Yeah, it was. I'm not going to lie. But, I mean, listen, one thing I learned from Leicester, even though, and even Cork City to that point, those players, and this is what I took with me, because, you know, You become the environments that you grow up in, right? So they always trained properly. You know, when it was time to train, they trained. But when they went out, they went out. It was that mentality, you know, work hard, play hard type of thing. So I kind of brought that with me when I went to Hull. I thought, well, because that's all I knew, you know, coming from Cork City to Leicester to Hull. I kind of thought, well, that's life, you know. You on a weekend, you get pissed, and you train hard during the week, but when you do go and get pissed, you come in Monday morning and, you know, you put on the old rain jacket with the jumper over the top and you plastic bags. Right. And you do some extra running afterwards on a Monday. So you've been at it, you know, that type of mentality, because that's what I saw growing up. And I thought that was normal. It was only years later that you realized that was insane, to be honest with you, what we were doing. But, like, you know, when you put 8 or 9 lads living, you know, in an apartment block in Hull, you know, on the same floor, I mean, it was, you know, it was like I'm not sure, like, I never went to college, but I'm pretty sure it was something similar to, like, a college-type lifestyle, you know.
And was it everything you hoped it would be? Like, was it, this is the dream, this is magic?
When you're winning, it's amazing. And we were, like, top of the league. We were going to get promoted. We were all 21, 22 years of age. Like you said, living in Hull, which is a massive city, but a bit small parish, if you know what I mean. I mean, everybody knows everybody there. And, you know, out on a Saturday night after a game, Sunday the same, but then Monday morning, you went back to work. And we never took the piss and stuff. I was going out during the week and stuff. You know, it was always after games and things like that. And when you're winning, I think Peter Taylor knew what was going on. He didn't care. He was, like, encouraging it, you know. He was like, yeah, crack on, do whatever you want to do. You know, as long as... But he always said to us, like, as long as you lads are winning games, I couldn't care what you do with your social lives, you know.
Yeah.
It was that type of mentality. But I'm pretty sure that if we started losing games or some of us, you know, performances dipped, he would come down on us like a ton of bricks or finished us, to be honest with you, you know.
So that's Hull City kind of 02 to 08. QPR 08 through to Ipswich 12. Those 4 years seem like, I don't want to put words in your mouth, so I'll just use a vague
shambles.
Less good, shambles.
Yeah, shambles.
Well, QPR was just the most dysfunctional club probably in Britain for a time. Yeah. Like, why'd you go there for?
I mean, ultimately...
Money,
yeah. I mean, you know, you couldn't say any other way, but, like, you know, I've been at Hull for so long.
I said money there in a disapproving tone, and I didn't like money. Money's a perfectly good reason. Jesus, I'm sure it was big money and life changing money. So why wouldn't you go?
It was because when I was at Hull had gone through so many changes, right, from like league to bottom of league to like, you know, top of the championship, and I was playing every week, and then the club started signing obviously bigger caliber of players. I mean, I remember, you know, Danny Mills came, JJ Kotcher came, Ray Parler came, Nicky Barnby came, you know, players, obviously top players, they had to pay top money to get them, and they did. And then there was kind of me in the corner going, you know, I'm playing every week, you know, and it was almost like, yeah. And you almost got treated like part of furniture. That's how I felt.
You never had an agent though?
Not really, no. Maybe I should have.
That's where you should have got Ray Parler's agent in to agitate on your behalf, no?
You know what, though? I just think that the club, they just looked at me as still as a 20-year-old that signed with nothing to lose and, you know, he's fine. You know, we only have a certain amount of money and we're going to spend it elsewhere because we know that, like, even if we kind of don't look after him, he'll still produce the goods for us because he's a good lad.
Yeah.
That's how I felt, like, you know, and that went on for about 2 or 3 years where I was.
And they were right. I mean, they were absolutely right.
Oh yeah, 100%. I'd still go on Saturday and like put my head in like where it hurt and like train with the dog during the week and just, you know, really pushed on and get the performances in. Even though I was probably the least paid in the squad, let alone like because I signed like a 3-year deal and then they kind of gave me a deal, pumped up a little bit, and I kind of was grateful for that. But then the club moved so fast that, like, all of a sudden, I was the tiny guy in the corner that was like, I can't believe these guys are getting paid this, I'm getting paid this. And I kept asking, and they just kept playing me along. And then, obviously, the opportunity came to go to QPR, and I basically went, like, you know, I'm going.
Yeah.
And they went to my staff. And then I went, really, you know. And, you know, it was London, it was West London, it was everything that you could dream of. You know? So you could imagine going from Cork to Diggs in Leicester to an apartment in Hull to West London. It was just the biggest eye-opener for me like that you could ever
have. Did you like London?
Loved it. I still do. It's the best city in the world. You know. But you have to have a tremendous amount of self-discipline to live in a city like London. And I mean a tremendous amount. Because, you know, if you've got a few quid in your pocket and you live in London, I mean, the possibilities are endless for you.
How would you fill your time in on a reasonably professional week?
When I was at QPR that time?
Yeah. Or even in Crystal Palace. Like, I don't mind either. But just, you know, when you're not kind of in and out of clubs or having a great time? And, you know, if you could spend on a quiet, like, would you just like walking around?
Oh, I love it. I would, like, I mean, there was many a time I got the tube from where I lived in West London down to like Aldgate East and walked back. I mean, 2-3 hours from like East London, you know, I mean, from Shoreditch all the way back up to Pimlico where I lived. It was just like fascinating, you know, walk past St. Paul's Cathedral into Covent Garden and, you know, into Soho and then into West London. And I would just put on my headphones and walk. And that's what I used to do regularly because, I mean, if you can't walk around London, even when you live there, and not be fascinated by everything that you see and the landmarks that you walk by and the history of the city, really, I mean, that's what I used to do. So, you know, when I wasn't living the high life, as you just said there, I would walk around London or go and sit in parks, you know. So I would go to, you know, Green Park or St. James's Park, and I, especially when the weather was nice, it's fabulous sitting in parks and you could pass away 2-3 hours there easily.
Would you have had, across your 20s or 30s, what percentage of your mates were from outside the world of football?
A couple back in Ireland, but that would be it, really.
Yeah. Is that just the way it fell? That's just the way life goes? Is that a regret or not too bothered either way?
No, you did. You did do a job. And, you know, football is, you know, you have a really close bond with the football, but after football, you don't. So you just spend a bit of time with the guys and you socialise with them. And that was about it, really. But ultimately, it was about football. So that's what we stayed focused on.
Yeah. QPR is a bit of a mess. I know Ipswich, like the Roy Keane thing comes up, and I don't want to turn this interview into a Roy Keane thing, and we talked about him loads before, but there was one point he made in his book. I don't know if you know this, you probably do.
Yeah, I know what you're going to say, but go on in there, sorry.
Do you? Well, it's a more conciliatory thing. This isn't inflammatory. It's where he says, Damien Delaney came in and did okay. This is him in his second book, Roddy Doyle, talking about Ipswich. Damien Delaney came in and he did okay. I was hard on him, probably because I knew him and he was from Cork. I went over the top. I was the same with another lad, Colin Healy. He was from Cork too. And I told him he was moving his feet like a League of Ireland player. It was wrong. Colin was new at the club. I should have been bending over backwards for him. I made the point about Ellis Shore talking to me. This is earlier on in the book where him and Ellis Shore have a disagreement. That's what he's referring to here. I made the point about Ellis Shore talking to me like I was something on the bottom of his shoe. I think I spoke to some people at Ipswich like that.
Yeah.
Had you heard that before?
No, I didn't hear all that, actually. All I heard was, I never read it, but I remember someone saying to me that he said something along those lines about that, you know, he was hard on me because I was from Cork.
It's a book where he's not afraid to have a kick at people as well. So, I mean, he could have just as easily had a kick at you. But it's interesting there, he says, I was over the top.
It's probably as close as an apology as you get from him.
Probably, yes. Yeah. pretty close to an apology there. Yeah.
He would ever actually say sorry for anything. But like, you know, it's fine, man. I don't hold any grudges or anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, he did what he thought was correct at the time, and he managed in a way that he thought was correct. And I was on the receiving end of a lot of it, an awful lot of it, to be honest with you. But like, it was fine, man. You know, when it wasn't fine at the time, because it grinds you down, you know. And I know, and I've laughed when people said this to me before, like, if Roy Keane is admitting that he was hard on you, could you imagine what I had to go through on a daily basis? You know, it was tough enough, and he did used to favour coming for me, you know. But again, you just try and take it on the chin and focus on the game and do what you can.
That's a Ferguson thing. Even Rooney a couple of weeks ago was talking about how Ferguson would pick his certain people to go at all the time. You know, so Keane would have seen Ferguson over, 12 and a half years. And Rooney was saying if Nani was losing the ball a lot, Ferguson would have a go at Giggs for losing the ball. And if Ronaldo was dribbling too much, he'd have a go at Rooney for dribbling too much. He would pick the people that he felt he could go at, clearly because he felt they could take it.
Yeah.
It doesn't make it right if you're the guy who's taking it every weekend.
Like after a while, I mean, I was there. I mean, I think it was his first signing. He was there in his last game when he got sacked. Like, and I think I said to you before, the only thing that kept me going was he picked me. So that kind of trumps everything. You know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, if a manager's having a go at you and you're not in the team, I think then, or even worse, if a manager's not having a go at you and you're not in the team, I mean, he doesn't think very much of you. And I think I played nigh on every game for him. There was a few times where I got banished because I made a mistake and whatnot for a game or two here and there. But I mean, nigh on every week I played for him. And kind of that's the only thing that consoled me through it was basically, you know, he can't think I'm that bad if he keeps picking me because he could pick other people. So he would destroy me on a Saturday after a game and then not speak to me for a week and then and then name the team on a Saturday and I'd be in it, like, you know.
Okay, yeah. that could mess with your head after a while.
Oh, like ridiculous, because I'm sitting there going, there's no way I'm playing on the weekend. I mean, he's literally walked past me in the corridor four times and just growled at me, like, and I'm going, Jesus, I'm what? Like, you know. And then he named the team on a Saturday and I'm like sitting there going, seriously, like, why, man? Why? Just drop me and put me out of my misery.
And a last one on that. Did you ever have the relationship where you could go to him and say, this is not much fun for me. Can we sort this?
Absolutely not. I wouldn't say no relationship with him, but like the only communication was him growling at me and that was it. Really, I just kind of sit there and look at the floor and just thought, go away in a minute. Just don't make eye contact with him and make it worse.
Because you leave, your 3.5 years there end by mutual consent. So I think, you know, that's kind of, that says what we need to know there. At that stage, you're 31.
Yeah.
And you've had your QPR experience, you've had your Ipswich experience, you're 31 years old. I mean, the scrap heap is beckoning. Come on in. You're winding down in a big way. You're not heading for the best part of your career.
Yeah, but like I played so many games as well. You know, I mean, I pretty much had played every week from the age of 21. Right. So I think I had a lot of miles in the clock. So I was kind of almost going, look, you played a lot of football, you know, there's not much else, you know, what are you going to do? Just scrap around and tack on another 100 games and what's that going to do for you? So that was kind of my thinking. I had nothing to prove, so to speak, because I played and I felt I was pretty decent and I felt that, you know, what are you going to do? Just kick around and scrap for a little bit of money and not really going anywhere. So I did give serious thought, or even more than serious thought, to just throwing a towel in really and just going, that's it, you know.
Would you have been bitter is too strong a word, but would you have left with a bad taste and thought that was a bit?
I can say no, but I think at the time, yeah. I mean, you know.
Well, I'm looking at it, and it's so Hull is great and everything, but so you're underpaid for a lot of those years at Hull. So the game didn't treat you maybe as well as it could have. You go to QPR, that's a mess. You go to Ipswich, that doesn't sound like it was pleasant. I could see how you'd walk away at 31 going, that's a rotten game, rotten industry.
That's it, man. And that's why a lot of people. And listen, I'm not getting on the violin for footballers here, but it's not an easy industry to survive in. And you've got to be prepared to take an awful lot of crap because you want to get it. And a lot of things are going to go against you and a lot of things are going to be very, very difficult. But look, it is what it is, man. And I'm just thankful that I didn't throw the towel in because I went on to have the best 6 years that anyone could ever actually have, you know?
Yeah. And... initially it's short term and it just sort of goes well. Isn't that kind of the gist of the Palace years, 2012 to 18?
Yeah, because I mean, when I went down there, it was Dougie Freeman just phoned me and he said, like, I mean, Paddy McCarthy, who's from Dublin and is U team manager there at the minute, was injured and he was club captain and kind of Tony Adams type character for Palace, you know, and he got injured. I think he dislocated his shoulder and Palace had lost their first 4 or 5 games of the season, like, badly, and then I think they lost in the League Cup to someone as well. Anyway, so Dougie phoned me and he said, look, I don't have any centre-halves. And I just left Ipswich at the time, you know. Paul Jewell came in after Roy, and I don't know, 18 months of Paul Jewell, who, you know, Julie wasn't as bad or anything like that, but look, it still wasn't great, you know. So I was done, and then Dougie just said to me, look, will you come down? And I knew Dougie just from playing against him. You know, Dougie was obviously retired and gone into management by then, but, you know, being a centre forward. And he just said, look, will you come down? Paddy's out for 3 months. I need a centre half for 3 months. And I was kind of thinking, oh, man, not really. I'm sure. And I think it was mid-September by then. And because I think I was released from Ipswich inside the window, I was free to sign for another club or something. I can't remember the ins and outs of it.
Yeah.
Something like that anyway. And I said to Dougie, yeah, fair enough, I'll go down and I'll fill a hole for 3 months, because I was going to come back to Ireland and just kind of take a few months off and settle down and let the dust settle and let my anger go and let my frustration go, and, you know, whether I went back to school or went out to America or whatever, you know. Bear in mind, by the way, at this stage now, I'm not financially, like, you know, in a great spot. You know, I'm okay for a little bit, but, you know, you still, you know, I made some good money out of the game, but I was underpaid at Hull for 5 or 6 years, and okay, I had a good couple of years at at Ipswich and QPR, but you know, once you factor tax into all that as well, you know,
yeah, you're not, you need to work again, yeah,
you know. So I kind of said, look, I might as well go, you know, rather than go home and spend. I think that's what my dad was saying to me. He said, you come home here and spend money, or you can stay there and make money. And I thought, well, all right, fair enough. I'll go down there for 3 months and see what happens. And fortunately, good things happened, you know.
They sure did. Did you always feel you were good enough to play in the Premier League? Like, was it a shock to you in terms of the quality? I know we've spoken before about how it came at a nice time for you physically, and that the demands of the Championship are relentless, and it's so many game after game after game, and it's a slog, and the Premier League isn't quite that. Obviously, it asks different questions. Did you have a few doubts about how you could hack Premier League strikers? We're talking about creme de la creme.
Of course, you know, I couldn't sit there and say to you that, no, I knew. But again, it was similar to the mindset that I had when I went over on trial. I just wanted to know.
To see, yeah.
That's all, you know, because not knowing must be the worst thing in anything in life, you know. And I just thought, I just want to know, like, you know. And I remember saying to Ian Holloway after the playoff final, like, I said to him, in the change room at Wembley, I said to him, give me the first game of next year. That's all I want.
So you've been promoted, you just don't want him to buy.
I mean, you know full well what's coming down the line. The club are going to spend money and whatever, whatever. And he was kind of in a good mood after winning. And I said, no, seriously, look at me and promise me, you give me the first game of next year. And if I'm useless and we get tanked, no problem. Do whatever you want. I said, but just give me a chance. And he did. He said, okay, I'll give you a chance.
All right.
And then the fixture just came out, and it was Spurs at home. And that was just after Spurs sold Bale and spent all that Bale money on like 5 or 6 superstars. I remember thinking to myself, oh my God.
Straight on the phone, Ian, you promised.
I was like, of all the games to get. But luckily, again, you know, I remember, I think it was the year Spurs signed Soldado, who obviously went on to be a huge flop, but at the time he was like coming up.
Yeah.
So like he was up front, and I was thinking, oh, here we go, like with Soldado, like what, you know. Luckily, we did really well in the game, and we lost to like an 81st minute penalty, believe it or not.
They say Soldado never psychologically recovered from that first game against Damien Delaney. He thought, I can't handle this.
I think he wasn't expecting a star.
You must have, in that first year, though, have experienced somebody where you thought, this is a bit different, this is a bit scary.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, without doubt, you know, and you have to accept that. Because they're very, very good players, you know. Yeah. So you have to kind of get your mindset to go, look, things are going to happen to you this year, and you're probably going to get embarrassed.
Yeah.
Look, you know, I said to Ollie, I wanted the first game of the season. And for the first year, I honestly took it on a game-by-game basis. Like, this is, you know, you have to play well. If you don't play well, you're out because the club have money. You know, you're going to be the first one out the door. So every Saturday, without going off too cliche on it, was a cup final for me. Every Saturday was my last Saturday. And that's how I approached every game, on that type of nervous edge of just like, you have to be at it today. Yeah. And that's how I approached it. And luckily we ended up, I mean, Ollie got sacked after Small and Pulis came in, and we ended up finishing, I'm going to say 10th, maybe 11th, I'm not sure, but like, which was a phenomenal achievement. You know, I think Tony Pulis got manager of the year that year, and he was the only time a manager outside of the top four has got manager of the year, which like will tell you how well we actually did, you know.
Here's a question without going into too much detail, obviously, but clearly Premier League wages, that is a different stratosphere to what you're going to earn previously, and what you can probably hope to earn in any realistic way for the rest of your life. What does seeing all that money land in your bank account, the sense of security it must give you, the options it must give you, like it strikes me as it still must be like a thrilling thing. Like, oh my God, this is going to transform the next 40 years of my life. Like, it's great. Or was it not a problem, but it can put you out of sync with friends or family, or maybe you feel guilty with all that money, or maybe it's more hassle than it's worth. But it strikes me as only a great thing if you've got your head anyway half screwed on.
Well, luckily by then I was 31, 32.
Yeah.
I dread to think, and I won't say I feel sorry for it, but like I have massive concern for young lads who sign huge contracts at 21, 22. Because if that must be, you know, a head spinner for them, you know.
Yeah.
I was 32 by then, and it made no difference to me. Not saying it made no difference, but you know, I realised, you know, I always had a little bit of money, so I was used to being okay. But yeah. Then obviously when you start getting bigger and bigger and bigger contracts, you know, the sums do start getting larger and larger. So it is almost a case of like, don't worry about it. And that's what I did really. I parked it. I just went, I always, you know, by then thought, you know, money is a byproduct of success. And I thought, as soon as I'm not being successful, it's going to stop. So just don't even look at it, man. Just take what you need to live for the month and just leave the rest. Okay. And money, you don't need to, like, you know, and as soon as you start enjoying that money is the time that that money will stop coming, because you take your eye off the ball. So that's what I did. I didn't really do anything.
Yeah.
I probably thought I was a bit of a Scrooge or whatnot, but it wasn't. I just needed to stay focused. And I didn't want to get involved in the fun and games that money can bring, especially living in town in London. It was just like, and I lived in town. So like it was, you know, Jesus.
You could find ways to spend it for sure. You took it in, you parked it, and you let it accumulate. I'm not going to worry about it, kind of thing.
And then yeah, and then I just got on my life, and I just kept going and going. And every now and again, you kind of go, okay, I'll do this, or I'll buy this, or I want to, whatever. And that's the way I looked at it, really. But in terms of being the age profile that I was, it was so much more easy to deal with, because I knew what was correct and what wasn't. And when people asked you for money, and believe me, like, you will get asked, like, you know, targeted by people with every investment under the sun, promising you the whole world. And if you give us this, we'll give you that. And I'm kind of going, how did you even get my number? You know what I mean? That type of stuff.
And Jesus, don't answer here by saying I got a nice watch. What was the best thing you were able to do with the money, either for yourself or someone else?
I suppose it bought me one of my hopes, really. That was probably the best thing, you know. So maybe that fourth course thing ended up did paying off for me.
You know, oh, well, that's a good answer. That's a great day to be able to do something like that's great.
But I mean, like, if it wasn't for her letting me leave school, and believe me, I had to get permission to leave school, like, none of it would have happened. So finally, when the first thing I did really buy a house myself was, you know, get her a reasonably nice house. So like, that's it now, really, to be honest with you.
Yeah, Palace. When you know, if there would maybe would have been a hint of. Again, bitterness might be too strong a word, because, you know, you're still at a great time. But when you retire from Palace, that's a much easier exit from the game, I presume. You're contented and happy enough to go, or was it still tough?
No. So my last year was brilliant. I think I only played one or two games my last year. But Roy Hodgson was a manager by then, and I will be forever grateful to that man for the way he treated me for last year, because it's not very often in football that people get to kind of choose their own ending, if you know what I mean. Normally you get turfed out and whatever, you know. I've waited a year to run on my contract, and I knew the club had moved on. You know, they just spent 28 million quid on Mamadou Sakho as a left side centre half. So when that happens, you know that it's over. And I was 36 ish, or maybe at the time 37, maybe, I'm not sure. So you kind of know that that's it. But I had a year to run my contract, and Roy treated me unbelievably well my last year. Like, he really, really did. You know, he really looked after me. He said to me, look, you're not going to be involved, but, like, you know, we should respect you. And I feel, and he said to me, that I feel you deserve to see your year out in your terms. So he said, whatever you need, if you have any problems, just come and see me, and I will endeavor to my small fella just had to run in the room. I was envisaging that BBC interview, you know.
It's happening a lot at the moment. Yeah.
So
that's great. Yeah, so wow, brilliant.
He was good to me, man. And I spoke to him a lot at my last year, you know, after training and stuff, because he knew that I wasn't a player, so you can have a different relationship with the manager then, right? So, you know, he was remember talking to me about management, you know, what he does when he was at Inter Milan, when he was at Liverpool, England, Swiss manager, you know, just talking to me about things, about his style of management and whatever. And I learned so much that year about the other side of it, you know, and how he is. And he's such a vastly experienced man, and such an amazingly intelligent man, really. Just to sit and speak with him for a period of time was fantastic.
And he's still there and still going strong.
He's unbelievable. I don't know where he gets his enthusiasm from.
Yeah. You were doing a roadshow recently, and Brian Kerr was making the point of you not being included in more Ireland teams and squads. He said it was one of the worst things that went on during Trapattoni's reign that Damien wasn't capped more. I was at a good few Crystal Palace games we covered at the time. He was playing outstandingly well and we needed someone of his ability to play. It was ridiculous stuff. It was uninformed. It was wrong. Someone should have said stop. Someone with the association should have went, you need to go and see that fella and how well he's playing. And then under Martin O'Neill and Roy, I think 65 minutes was about the extent of it in a friendly against Turkey. And there was a period there where only you and Kieran Clark were the Premier League centre-halves. So if you were to sum it all up, what happened there? Like, it's easy to look at the Roy Keane thing and suspect there was a hangover from Ipswich, or was there a chemistry issue with O'Neill? Trapattoni wasn't interested. How would you sum up what went on?
It was just a case of bad timing. And it doesn't bother me at all. But when I was playing under Trapattoni, you know, John O'Shea was there, Richard Dunn, you know, Nothing Ledger. You guys were playing week in, week out. You know, Dunny was doing what he was doing. Ledge was a different man when he played for Ireland. You know, he was brilliant. And like, so I went in and I was part of all the squads and, you know, for 4 or 5 years, travelling into Dublin and sitting on the bench and picking up the odd cap in the end of the season friendly. So what am I going to do? Go and see the gaffer, Trapattoni, and say, I want to play instead of Dunny. I mean, come on, man.
Yeah, so that's fair enough then, actually.
So I accept that. But then, you know, the Martin O'Neill thing kind of came in and I was getting older at the time and it is what it is, man. But I can't complain. You know, I've had more of the game than I could ever have imagined or wanted. So, you know, if something didn't go as well as what I would have hoped, I have to accept it, man, to be honest. Yeah, and I do accept it. And life is fun, man.
Okay. It is what it is. One of the great quotes. I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, it's all going to be your best job.
So I know you get asked about this a lot. You probably will keep being asked about it when you do interviews until you figure out what you're going to do. Maybe you don't have to figure out what you're going to do. But I know Roy Hodgson told you to take time and you're in the midst of doing that now. Are you any closer towards figuring things out? Have you ruled anything in or out? Like, have you ruled out management and being on the training ground? Have you ruled in or out media? Where's your head and how much of a rush are you in?
I'm in absolutely no rush because at the minute, I have my hands full, you know, at home here. And I'm quite content at the minute. So I'll be very, very slow to change anything at the moment. And things are okay. The bit of advice that Roy Hodgson that you referred to there said to me, he said, like, go away from football for a couple of years, he said, and learn about life and learn about something different. He said, if you come straight out of playing, go straight into management, you know, you'll never fully grasp, he said, if you want to be a manager, he said, because your head's just continuously spinning from playing to management. He said, it's very, very difficult, he said, and you'll burn out very, very quickly. So he said, just take some time, learn, read, and develop as a person. And if you feel like you want to come back in, then he said, you're coming with a completely different viewpoint, but still with all the knowledge that you have from when you played, he said, you'll come in then like in a much better mindset. So I'm not ruling out management. At the moment, I don't feel the desire to do it. Coaching, the same. And at the minute, I'm enjoying being with you guys on Off the Ball. I am. I enjoy going up and doing the shows. It's a great setting where you can just talk and get across the point of what you're trying to say. And it's not more about some bitey journalism where, you know, for headlines and stuff. So it's a good setting where you can sit and talk whatever you want. And some people agree, some people disagree, but it's a viewpoint, you know, and I am enjoying that. So at the moment, I'm not really going to change the situation. Really.
And you're enjoying Cork. What's it like? What's it like going back? Because, you know, there's that thing, isn't there, when you leave a place for a long time and then you come back after being not a stranger in different lands, but a blow-in. When you return after a long period, you're sort of a blow-in in some respects when you go back because it's changed so much. What's it been like going back home?
I loved it. I love it. Every day, I think it's a fantastic place to live. It's a fantastic place to bring kids up. And that was the primary reason in coming back, really, putting down some roots. And I know the childhood that I had, his safe environment would be the same for him, you know. And, you know, it was important for me, you know, for him to go to street leagues and schoolboy football and stuff like that. And I want him to, you know, experience hurling and football and rugby and pick whatever sport he wants, you know. So at the moment, this is where I am. He's really happy here. we're really happy here. People of Cork are fantastic. I think people from Cork always return home eventually, don't they? Cork's a bit different.
We're well aware of Cork being a bit different. Listen, it's been great. It's been fun. I kind of found out a few things I hadn't fully realised, so I really enjoyed it. Hopefully we're in a studio reasonably soon talking about Champions League games, incredible. So, Damon Delaney, it's been brilliant. Thanks so much again. Appreciate it. Stay safe. Back to that garden.
Take care of yourself.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.